Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm your host, Grace Wan. The government shutdown has hit day 40, but there appears to be some hope that a compromise may be reached. However, the impacts of the shutdown will be felt by voters for days and weeks to come. One example, tonight we'll be talking about how people are going hungry because the government cut off SNAP benefits and how those people are being helped by Bay Area food banks. Later in the hour, we'll hear from singer, songwriter, and composer Macleet Hadero. If you've never heard of her, add her to your Spotify list because her music is transportative. But first, we're talking with Congresswoman Latifah Simon. She represents the 12th District, a seat formerly held for years by Oakland Mayor Barbara Lee. And we are so delighted that Congresswoman Simon is here at State of the Bay. Welcome.
Welcome. Welcome back to you. Thank you so much for getting into the deep about what's happening here in D.C.
Well, last night, eight senators who caucus with Democrats broke ranks and advanced a plan that would fund most federal agencies at least through January. I'm curious, how do you feel about this deal?
Funny you ask. It's a trillion-dollar question. I'm extremely disappointed. Again, the shutdown was on the Republicans. And I think that it's gotten pretty confusing with the chaos that has been going on all over your airwaves, your TV. In the beginning of the year, you will recall that there was this bill passed by a very slim margin called the Big Ugly Bill. And it's about 1,000 pages of horrific policy. That bill passed, again, with a very slim margin in the House, in fact, by one vote, went to the and it was signed by the president. There, it's so much corruption, thievery, and racism, and misogyny, you name the bill. But a component of the bill proposes to take away health care from 17 million people in this country over the next 10 years. And we've been extremely clear that everything in that bill is garbage, but to stake claim on the sickest, the poorest, the elderly, it was a non-starter. And if they would have gained the problem negotiating with us, we'd be in a different place. The Republicans refused to negotiate with Democrats, a refusal. And so again, when the bill has gone up for funding, and when we initially had a Senate that unity stood up, and absolutely not. There's such law with funding this bill, but healthcare for the sickest, again, for the eldest, for the disability, we won't do it. And that's where you saw the shutdown. Now, we have been in the House for the House Democrats, at least, for the last 50 plus days since Mike Johnson decided to close the floor of the House of Representatives. The Senate has been struggling. And last night, there were a few Democrats, none of them up for a re-election in 2026. They were safe. They decided for whatever reason that they were going to capitulate. I will say for the folks in our district, the folks who are listening, every single day of the shutdown, I know that real folks have been going hungry. Folks haven't been able to get their Social Security. 10,000 workers, federal workers, were either furloughed or everyone wasn't paid. So that pain was extremely real. And playing with people's lives, that was a decision. That was a decision on the Republicans. So yes, I'm angry because they voted last night with a promise that we'll continue to have talks about restoring healthcare for the American people that's affordable. We don't believe as House Democrats that we can believe the Republican Party. So yes, I'm angry.
Mm. Well, even if this deal does pass, and it sounds like it's going to pass without your vote, what are Democrats going to do to help keep the government from shutting down again? Or is that something that Democrats want?
I think that it's an interesting question because Democrats didn't want a shutdown in the first place. Now, if folks are calling on Democrats to rubber stamp Republican legislation that keeps people sick and keep people poor, that's something that we just cannot do. At least House Democrats cannot do that. I know I will not do that. So what we have to do in the minority is literally fight and use every tool that we have. And I'm not talking about the tool of shutdown. I'm talking about the tool of, you know, linking arms with our movement partners, our litigation partners, really pushing back against what the other side of the aisle is trying to inflict on the American people. I want to be clear, there's not been one day of this shutdown that I have been proud that folks are going without. Mm-hmm. Again, this is the position that the Republicans have placed the American people in. And again, what can the Democrats do to stop mass police from coming in cities and stealing people from their homes with no due process? What can Democrats do to stop the Trump administration of going after LGBTQ folks? And what can we do to stop the Trump administration from feeding the rich with the poor's resources? You know, I say it's our vote. But again, what we're doing is fighting. We're fighting, we're fighting. This is on them. They got the House, they have the Senate, they have the judiciary, and they have the executive branch. And so again, while these votes at the House is going back into session this week, and again, what I have as your representative is my vote. That is what I do have. And I will continue to vote the conscience of our district.
Well, you know, last week with the election and the passage of Prop 50 and across the country, Democrats did so well, from small offices to big ones. But there seems to be a real frustration on the left that the Democrats appear almost toothless in this fight. This shutdown was a way to leverage some power. And as we said, there were a lot of wins. What do you say to Democrats who feel like the leadership of the Democratic Party doesn't seem to be standing up to the moment?
I'm an organizer. I come from the ground. And if your base is telling you one thing and you're doing the other, that is a problem. And so I am proud to be a House Democrat in the House of Representatives, because our delegation has stayed clear and conscience on this particular bill. We have been clear what we believe the American people deserve. Now, only 8 members of the Senate Democrats decided to go along with Republicans. They do not represent my district. They do not represent, I believe, the voice that is coming from the ground all over the country saying what we need and what we deserve. The power in the people really, again, rests in 2026 and beyond, and in the next Senate elections when we get to choose our leaders. It's the reason why, again, as an organizer who has had a lot of issues with the Democratic Party, I did choose to run because my job literally is to extend the voice of the folks in my district in that building.
Well, do you support Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries and how he's managed this shutdown? And same question about Chuck Schumer for this on the Senate side.
Well, clearly, I don't support what's happened in the Senate. I support Leader Jeffries in being consistent in saying the House Democrats must not capitulate. And I'm proud that we, to this point, as of today, we have stood unified. It is the job of any leader to articulate really the voice, the vision, and the mission of said institution. And I am proud that to this moment, Leader Jeffries has been clear that we have to hold the line, and I am holding the line. I'm not holding the line because Speaker Jeffries said so. I'm holding the line because, you know, the young person at Children's Hospital that I met that needs a heart transplant needs me to hold the line. The seniors that I've worked with in my district who deserve to live the last decade or years of their lives with dignity, they want me to hold the line. The airport workers that I've worked with and talked to and huddled together in downtown Oakland, they want me to hold the line. The Social Security workers want me to hold the line. So that's what I'm doing. What I won't do is speak for the whole party. I won't speak for the whole, I won't speak for all the House Democrats. What I will do, even when I go up against maybe what leadership wants to do, I want you to know that my job is to lend our values to that floor. And that's what I'm going to continue to do.
Well, even if this extension passes or this compromise passes, there's no extension of the health insurance subsidies that the Democrats have been pushing really hard for. And, you know, what do you say? I mean, it must be a little bit hard to look your constituents in the eye. You're getting paid. And a lot of your voters were not during this shutdown.
Yep.
And, you know, and their premiums are doubling, tripling, you know. What are you saying to them about what should they do? What can they do?
Our constituents, the 10,000 federal workers in my district, one, they deserve better. The 240,000 folks who are on food stamps, they deserve better. The folks like me who lost a spouse, who have to wait weeks upon weeks for a death benefit from Social Security, they deserve better. So, you know, I came into the Congress, again, as someone who was a teen mom. You know my background, who went into horrific debt after my husband died. I'm raising my children alone. You know, I came to Congress to literally transfer what I know is also true, how the poor, how the elderly, how the folks who are working with their full bodies consistently get disrespected, sometimes by both parties. And so, again, I am not tap dancing for anyone outside of the people that put me in Congress. So what I've been telling them is, one, you don't deserve this. What do you think? Having those kitchen conversations in the last 50 days, being in the district for much of this time, I've had a real beautiful and amazing and humbling opportunity to talk with folks who weren't getting paid. I have been, you know, speaking with community banks who have been providing no interest loans to federal workers. I've been talking to and sorting carrots at the food bank with volunteers who too understand and know that in our district, if you're hungry, you're going to eat. And I also come from a tradition where government never did what it said it would do for the folks who deeply deserved it. And, you know, when they shut down our schools, we created our own. When they didn't let us go into our hospitals, we trained ourselves as healers. You know, when they burned down our communities, we built them back up. And it's not toting the line for the Democrats. Toting the line is toting the line for the 760,000 people that I represent who want a government that works deeply for them. And cutting off health care for tens of millions of people, to me, is a non-starter. And the folks that I have been talking to, some very frustrated, the hundreds that have been calling my office, we've been taking their calls and processing their cases. Because you know what we haven't done in my office? We haven't closed down.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, you're one of 538 people to try to get legislation passed and things done. And I'm just curious, I think that, you know, the ACA actually helps a lot of red states. And we've seen people like even Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has had praise for what the ACA has done. We've seen in Missouri, their Senator Tom Cotton saying that we should pass, you know, some relief for on the ACA. What can you do to convince Republicans that they need to support health care for the people who need it the most?
You know, I plan. It's such a great question. As a freshman member, folks say there's so many limits of what you can do because, again, you're right. I'm not a principal. I'm a legislator. Both Republicans who are in the legislature, who are in high levels of government, and their constituents who vote red, they know and they have felt it that government is supposed to work for folks who need it the most. And I'll be spending a lot of next year in my district, but also all over the country, campaigning and working with members of the House so that we can take the House back. Candidates who, again, need to take Republican seats in the South and in the Midwest. And, you know, what our song is going to be, it's going to be a song about basic rights. It's health care, it's Social Security, it's housing prices. I don't know if you've been to Sprouts or even Grocery Outlet lately. Things aren't getting cheaper.
Yeah.
the letters that folks who are small business owners that they got in the mail, they're in the ACA marketplace in Oakland, in Berkeley, in Emeryville, in Alameda, in Albany, Pima. Their rates have tripled in real time just in the last couple of weeks because that big ugly bill takes away from the poorest among us and gives to the rich. So what I'm going to be doing is doing what I do well, is organize and tell the human story to both the legislatures and the legislators and folks on the ground all over the country of what the vision should be. And the vision is there is enough for all of us. There is enough for all of us. And the folks who need the least shouldn't have the most. And that's just basic. That's what you tell your child when they go to school. If you have a sandwich and someone's sitting next to you and they're hungry, I'm going to tell my daughter to make sure that they share. Just share. It's simple.
Well, we really appreciate your time and thank you for sharing your thoughts with us this evening. Thanks for joining us on State of the Bay, Congresswoman.
I'm so blessed to have you all in community sharing the news. Thank you.
That was Congresswoman Latifah Simon, who represents the 12th District, and we'll hopefully hear more from her in future shows. And coming up next on State of the Bay, with SNAP benefits still in flux, we'll talk with local groups that are making sure Bay Area residents have enough to eat. Stay with us.
Oh. On the next Your Call, we'll mark Veterans Day by speaking with veterans against fascism and discuss Tuesday's Vets Say No actions across the country. Veterans say we're saying no for our families, for our communities, and for ourselves. No to cuts, no to troops being deployed in our streets, and no to billionaires bleeding our nation dry. Join the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.
That's Your Call tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock here on KALW. And coming up at 7 o'clock after the conclusion of State of the Bay, stay with us for the authoritarian playbook. Now, back to State of the Bay.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Grace Wan. During the shutdown, President Trump decided to cut off SNAP benefits. SNAP is a food assistance program that over 40 million Americans rely on to put food on their tables. In California, the program is called CalFresh, and it serves 5.5 million Californians, which includes 2 million children. State and local governments like San Francisco have scrambled to help ensure that CalFresh recipients get some or all of their benefits. In the meantime, Trump and Republicans are demanding that states, quote, undo their efforts to help the hungry. It's certainly a strange world we are living in, but tonight we get to talk to folks who are trying to make that world a little bit better. Joining us, we've got a full house of helpers, and we'll start with Danielle Echeverria. She's a data reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, who's been mapping where hunger and food insecurity are hitting hardest across California. Welcome to State of the Bay, Danielle.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
We're also joined by Tanis Crosby, executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. Welcome, Tanis.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I also want to welcome Laura Bent. She serves as the CEO of Samaritan House in San Mateo County. Hi, Laura.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. And finally, we have Gordon Tong. He's a program manager for waste reduction in San Mateo County. That might sound like taking out the trash, but it really is all about making sure food gets repurposed. Glad you could join us, Gordon.
Thank you for having me.
And before we begin, we want to hear from you listeners. Have you lost SNAP benefits or know somebody who has? Where are they or you turning for groceries or food? And are you looking for tips on how to help, to donate food or volunteer? You can give us a call, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on social media. We're at State of Bay. Danielle, I wanted to start with you. These are confusing times. And I wanted to ask, where do we stand with SNAP benefits right now? Are they in place for Californians or not?
That is a great question. And things are very uncertain. There has been a lot of back and forth in the courts over the last week about whether the SNAP benefits will be funded. Federal judges have ordered the Trump administration to fully fund the SNAP benefits. The administration said it would partially fund it, then it said it would fully fund it, then states started giving out the money, and then the Trump administration said, undo that, take it back. So where things stand right now is very uncertain. The Trump administration is trying to get the courts to hold off until the government reopens. But the point being, people who rely on these benefits likely do not have all of the money that they need for the month.
Mm. Well, your recent article in the Chronicle lays out how many Californians do rely on SNAP, as we talked about in the introduction, and how disruptive this shutdown has been. I mean, we live in a region where, you know, a latte will cost you $5 at Starbucks. So it's hard to parse this idea of food insecurity and the levels of which we have it in the Bay Area. Can you tell us a little bit about what your reporting has shown in terms of the threat to food security?
Yeah, so in San Francisco in particular, there are 110,000 people who rely on these SNAP benefits. It's about 13% of the city as of the last few months. And 45% of those people are elderly in San Francisco. About 17% are children. So, you know, it is, like you said, we live in a very expensive area, and you really do see how that impacts so many people in our city.
Yeah, and we're saying SNAP, but it's also called CalFresh. And do you have a sense, I mean, what is the actual monthly payment somebody on CalFresh usually gets? Is it depend on the size of their family or where they live?
Yes, it does depend on the size of the family and, you know, different eligibility requirements. It's complex, but it's, you know, a few hundred dollars usually.
Yeah, it is not a lot. And, you know, Tanis, I wanted to turn to you as a leader of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank. You really are on the front lines when federal aid like this stalls. What have you been seeing as the shutdown has dragged on? Has there been a notable increase in demand for the food bank's services?
Yeah, that's a great question. But just to ground us into where we are right now, food insecurity is actually higher now than at the height of the pandemic. So again, to be clear, food insecurity is at historic highs. That was before the compounding impact of inflation. That's before these policy measures in HR 1, sometimes known as the, quote, one big beautiful bill, let's call it HR 1 tonight. Those have not been fully felt all across our communities, and that's before the government shutdown. So food insecurity was already high. When you add to that this fear of how ICE raids are impacting our communities and fear in accessing food, fear in the continuation of entitlements like CalFresh, this is just not tenable for our communities. Folks are already struggling. But here's the good news. Local action matters. In San Francisco, with the help of a local foundation, Crankstart, and in partnership with San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Mayor Daniel Lurie and San Francisco Human Service Agencies took action, and there was a one-time prepaid grocery card provided to participating households who are part of the CalFresh program. So aid was delivered, it was provided, and in these times, these uncertain times when so much is happening federally, it's about local action and advocacy, because we cannot food bank our way out of the dismantling of our nation's most effective anti-hunger, anti-poverty program. Local action with policy change, I'm feeling hopeful, I'm determined. People are suffering, and we must not fail to take action.
Well, I wanted to focus on that partnership that you had with the city and the foundation Crankstart in getting money into the hands of people who needed it. I mean, my understanding was that that happened in a matter of days, that you all just really put, you know, pushed pedal to the metal and just went for it to get, electronic cards to the recipients who needed it.
Yeah, this was a partnership with an organization called Give Card. They did a lot of good work in the LA fire response. But the bottom line is leaders decided to take action. Mm-hmm. Crankstart Foundation said this is important. And because of these efforts, over 110,000 people in San Francisco didn't have the fear of wondering if their benefits would come and if so, when. I'm also really grateful that in California, the benefits have been fully restored. That action was taken late Thursday evening and into Friday and Saturday. So this is what happens when elected leaders make choices that people should not experience hunger. You know, California is the fourth largest economy in the world, and I would like to forge this moment with even greater commitment that policy change can happen. It should happen. Hunger is a policy choice, not a personal choice, and we need to double down on our efforts. At the food bank, we take a lot of pride. We are unapologetic in making sure that people have beautiful, nourishing food that is desired and culturally responsive so that people have the food they need today. But our mission is to end hunger, not just manage it. So we are focused not only in making sure that our neighbors who need us get the food they need today, but that we're working on some short and midterm solutions, not just this direct financial assistance that happened in San Francisco, but we really need to double down on our efforts because CalFresh, it's not adequate, access is tough, and we know that anti-hunger, anti-poverty programs work. We just need to make sure we've got them.
Mm-hmm. Well, Laura, Samaritan House serves thousands of families on the peninsula. And, you know, maybe we don't think about the peninsula as a place that might have food insecurity. But how are you adjusting your programs in light of this SNAP uncertainty? Because certainly there is a lot of food insecurity down there.
Yes, thank you. I mean, despite, you know, Silicon Valley's affluence, you wouldn't think, as you said, San Mateo County would have food insecurity given the affluence in our community. But this region actually has a food insecurity rate higher than the national average. And this is directly due to the high cost of living in the community. So at Samaritan House, you know, we've had to pivot at this time to really ensure, as Tana said, the community has risen and came together and got food, food drives going, money, because we can leverage the money even better and create more meals out of a dollar than the typical family can. And so we've had to ramp up our volunteer support. We've had to ramp up some staffing due to the community support that we've gotten to ensure that we can meet the needs of the new clients who are walking through our door.
Well, tonight we are discussing how the disruption of SNAP benefits are affecting the Bay Area and how local organizations are responding. We're joined by Danielle Echeverria of San Francisco Chronicle, Tanis Crosby from the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Laura Bent from Samaritan House, and we'll hear from Gordon Tong shortly from San Mateo County. And listeners, we want to hear from you. If you've lost SNAP benefits or know somebody who has, how are you getting food onto the table? And have you noticed longer lines at your local food pantry, or do you know of efforts in your neighborhood to help people get groceries? You can give us a call now at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@klw.org. You're listening to State of the Bay, and I'm your host, Grace Wan. Gordon, I wanted you to explain a little bit about your program down in San Mateo. It's something about recycling food to make sure that it doesn't go to waste. How is that helping in this crisis?
Sure. Yeah. The program we run is called Edible Food Recovery. So in essence, it's a really simple idea. I mean, we all know that there's extra food that doesn't get sold or eaten at grocery stores or large catering facilities and things like that. Before, that food would go into the landfill or compost. But through the Edible Food Recovery program, that food instead is going to families and neighbors who are hungry, which is especially important during this critical time when SNAP benefits are so uncertain. The main driving force behind this program is actually California's Senate Bill 1383. That requires a 75% reduction in landfilling organic waste, but it also includes a component around recovering this edible food by 20%. And this is important because it not only helps families in need, like I said, but it helps reduce the amount of methane that is in the landfills, which is a greenhouse gas pollutant. The law requires that the grocery stores, hotels, large catering businesses, and businesses like that donate extra food that they have to local edible food recovery organizations like Samaritan House, food banks, and nonprofits. Our department, we run the program on behalf of all the 20 cities and towns in San Mateo County to create one big system that meets both this law, but also the local needs of our community. We help food businesses donate extra food by linking these grocery stores with these food recovery organizations, and we help fund a lot of the trucks, the storage, and other facilities that they need to collect and distribute this edible food. And through this program, we can recover both food that's safe to heat, but also support our climate change and waste reduction goals throughout the state.
Mm. Laura, I mean, how critical are donations from this, the program that Gordon described?
Absolutely critical to the organization that I represent, Samaritan House. We saved, through this grocery rescue partnership, we saved just over 1.2 million pounds of food last year from going into the landfill by getting it into our food pantry area and getting it out to the community within 24 hours. So that's food out of the stores, not going into the landfill, right into the hands of the people who really, really need it and can use it.
That's amazing. Let's go to the phones. We've got Al from Pizza Place on the line. Al, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I understand that you are trying to do your part as a restaurant owner to help families who are suffering at this moment. What are you doing?
Well, my wife and I, Deanna, Tony and Alba's Pizza, are feeding SNAP families the children pizzas and or pastas and giving like 60% off the adults if they want to have some food. So we feed them either pizza, pasta, some carrots, an apple, and some. One of the vendors that worked with us gave us cookies. So we give them cookies too.
Well, what led you to start this program? Is this something that you always have, or is this something that you did in response to hearing about what's happening?
Well, we have a program called Random Acts of Pizza. Call it Wrap with Tony Navas, in which we feed needy families pizza, drinks, salad, desserts for the kids so they can dive in and have a family dinner on us. And that's supplied by our customers. They give us $10. We pay the difference. So we kind of, my wife and I were talking about it, and my wife's going, hey, you know, these kids, come SNAP is going to be gone. We didn't think it'd be gone, but it was going to be gone. She goes, these guys are not going to be able to eat at night. Sure, they get breakfast and lunch, but a kid not eating at night, and he has to go all night and maybe not have food and stuff. So she said, let's get going on this. And so we started it up. We've always been community driven. Her parents, who owned the place before us, was always community driven. And so I put out an Instagram post thinking, oh, we're going to start in a few days. Somebody calls direct immediately to my wife. My wife goes, well, I think we're going to start. And then she started. She saw me come in with a handful of apples and carrots and stuff. She goes, it's now. We start it now. So that was our first SNAP family that came in.
Are you finding that people are taking advantage of the program? I mean, actually utilizing it?
They are. It could be more. I think SNAP families are embarrassed. I had one come in Saturday. And she leaned over the counter and she goes, I'm embarrassed to ask this, but are you guys giving away the free meals? So I think that they're embarrassed to do it because they feel like, you know, they feel like they're embarrassed to ask for it. And it's there. We have it. We have vendors. I've had our customers have helped finance. I've had vendors give us food. We have food to give. In fact, if they do have it start up again, which I know it's still in debate, we're going to be able to do this process till the first of Thanksgiving, and then we're going to pivot it back into our WAP program for the rest of the year. But we're going to be doing this all the way till the day before Thanksgiving, even if they finance everything. Because our customers have been incredible. Our vendors have been incredible. Our friends, everybody, have really supported us on this mission. And I just want to tell people, don't be embarrassed. We're here to help you. There's people out there that always need help. We've all gone through needing help. My wife's father was in the hospital for like 3 or 4 months. My mother-in-law didn't speak much English then, didn't have a job, and she had 4 kids. People helped her out, and that's where my wife remembers people helping her out in a time of trouble. So anybody out there, time of trouble, come back.
Well, tell us for people who are not familiar with your restaurant, tell us where you're located.
Sure. Well, we're Tony and Alvis Pizza. We're at 3137 Stevens Creek Boulevard. It's the intersection of Winchester and Stevens Creek. We're by Valley Fair and Santana Row in a little shopping center right there. And easy parking, come on by, you know?
Well,
questions asked. We're there to help you.
I hope people will. Well, thanks for calling in, Al. It's a great story to share. Tanis, I wanted to pick up on something that Gordon said, which is the shame that some people might feel in seeking benefits, in their inability to feed their families, which, I mean, is the cutting off these benefits compounding that and making it more difficult for you to reach out to your clients?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, folks reach out to the food bank when they're having a really bad day. It is hard to ask for help. And what I appreciate about that business leader is to create the conditions where people can give and receive help without shame. All of us at some points in our lives needed help. All of us at some points in our lives can give and offer help, and we are committed to providing food access programs that are grounded in dignity and access and choice. What I'm so grateful for is programs like Farm to Family. We talked about a food recovery program, and that's important. And these ways in which we are recovering food, like what Laura spoke to and Gordon, food banks have a similar program at scale with farmers and food producers. It's called Farm to Family. It was started in 2005 at San Francisco Marin Food Bank that's now scaled all across California. We recover 200 million pounds of food each and every year directly from farmers, food producers. this is food that might otherwise go to waste because maybe the carrots are a little big or the watermelons are too small, but it's beautiful food. Mm. It's seasonal food. So when you walk into a San Francisco Marin Food Bank program, it feels like a farmer's market. There is bountiful seasonal produce that is culturally responsive. Over 90% of our participants say they like the food, it is culturally responsive, and they are less hungry because of these programs. It is all about dignity, is all about access. And so my message to folks is, it's okay. It's okay. And when we share food, you're going to feel cared for. This is about community taking action to care for each other. It's also about community taking action in both service and in a fight for social change. Mm. It is both. We've got to keep it going on both fronts because that's what is required of us in this moment.
Well, Danielle, even when and if the shutdown ends, I mean, food benefits are still kind of at risk or in play because of the changes that Republicans made in the budget bill that passed earlier this summer. I mean, what are the challenges Californians and recipients of CalFresh/SNAP will be facing even without a shutdown?
Well,
yes.
Oh, go right ahead.
Well, I was going to say, Tanis, you did mention this earlier, but essentially, yeah, in the mega bill that passed earlier this summer, the tax cuts and spending bill, the Republican lawmakers voted to sort of tighten the eligibility requirements for SNAP. And effectively what that means in the state is that, hundreds of thousands of people stand to lose these benefits. Tanis, I'm sure you can speak to this more as someone who is on the front lines of dealing with that and helping people navigate it.
Yeah, and feel free, Tanis, to go ahead.
Yeah, in California, there are 5.4 million people that benefit from SNAP. And as Danielle said, these are children, 1.5 million children, over a million seniors. A lot of folks are working families just trying to make ends meet and balance it out each and every month. With the cuts that have been approved, California families could lose 1.1 billion meals. Hmm. Just last year, California food banks distributed enough food to make over 600 meals. The point is, we can't food bank our way out of the cuts that are coming.
Wow. Laura, I mean, it's not easy to get SNAP benefits. There's a process. It's not always clear. You're dealing with people who, you know, they're having, as Tanis said, like maybe the worst time in their lives. And so they're seeking the help that they need. What does your organization do to help people get the benefits that they are entitled to under the law?
So that's a great question. And I appreciate it. The staff that we have a whole client services department that meets with clients when they are first joining Samaritan House and ongoing. They provide intensive case management support, essentially counseling on how to navigate the difficult waters of getting connected to not only benefits, but other resources in the county. And so our staff is trained to sort of be the generalist in all of the work that goes on in the county so that when somebody comes in, we know all of the resources that are availed and we know all of the ways to get them connected to the benefits and the resources that are in our community. And so we take the time, we assess the needs. You know, people come in crisis, we take the time to really go through the crisis, but also get a holistic picture of what's going on with the household so that we can ensure that we're getting them all of the resources and access to the benefits that they need. We do direct work with partners so that if someone is trying to sign up for CalFresh, we work directly with, we have benefits analysts from the county in our offices to directly connect them and get them through the process same day. So it's really critical that we have the staff who are trained and ready to go to meet people where they are and get them the support that they need.
Well, it's Thanksgiving, and I think a lot of people during this time of year in particular think about giving back, helping out, volunteering. I myself, I love volunteering at the food bank. I love that Illinois Street Warehouse, Tanis. So I wanted to give you, Tanis, and Laura a chance to shout out how people can help, what they can do. So Laura, I'll start with you. What can people do to help your organization?
Awesome. Thank you for that question. I have very quick bullet points for people to remember. Keep it easy. If you have the ability, donate funds. For every dollar that we receive, we can create 4 to 6 meals. Again, we can leverage that dollar really well. If you have the ability to run a drive, or like the other gentleman that was talking about his business, and do something for the community and quickly get access to food and provide it to organizations like mine that are throughout the whole community, please go ahead and contact us. We know how to tell you how to run a food drive really easily, and we make it very simple for you. Lastly, I will say volunteer. If you have the time and you have the ability, really take the time to come and volunteer. Not only will you feel good at the end of it, you will have a fun and amazing time, and you will meet incredibly resilient people while you do it.
Tanis, we have 1 minute left. How can we volunteer with your organization?
So first of all, shout out to Samaritan House. Laura, great work. Thank you. If you'd like to volunteer at the food bank, please, sfmfoodbank.org, and consider volunteering in January. We'd love to welcome you in January when volunteering tends to decline. If you can give a dollar, we'll make it stretch. 94 cents goes directly into our programs. Every dollar counts. Every hour counts.
Well, I will see you all in January, and I hope our listeners will be there too. We've been talking about our neighbors, our friends who are in need of help and need that food on their table, and there's so much more to discuss, so I hope we have a chance to do it in the future. We spoke to Danielle Echevarria. She's a data reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, Tanis Crosby, executive director of the San Francisco Marin Food Bank, Laura Bent, CEO of Samaritan House, and Gordon Tong, program manager for waste reduction in San Mateo County. Thanks to all of our listeners for listening in, and thanks to you all for joining us. More State of the Bay after this break.
A bipartisan group in the Senate reached a deal to reopen the government. It could mark the final days of the longest shutdown in U.S. history. But it happened because some Democrats broke rank with their party. Is it splitting the Democrats? We'll have the latest on that and reporting on if or when the government may reopen on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Hear that tomorrow morning from 5 to 9. We bring you Morning Edition every weekday here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Ira Glass. On This American Life, we like stories that surprise you. For instance, imagine finding a new hobby and realizing
to do this hobby right, according to the ways of the masters, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to have to bend the law to get the materials that you need.
If not break it.
Yeah, to break international laws.
Real life stories, really good ones, every week.
This American Life, hear that edition tomorrow afternoon at 4.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your vibe curator and selector. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. If that snippet of music you just heard mesmerized you, consider yourself a fan of Mclete Hadero. An Ethiopian-American musical artist, Mclete Hadero is known for her innovative vocals and dynamic stage presence. After attending Yale, she came out here and has called the Bay Area home for the last 21 years. She's graced stages across the world, been a senior TED fellow, lectured at Stanford and Harvard, and is the co-founder, co-producer, and host of Movement, a podcast that explores global migration through music, which will be featured on KALW series Bay Made the week of November 17th. We're delighted to welcome this multi-hyphenate to State of the Bay. Welcome, Mclete.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, when I speak to musicians, I'm always interested in hearing how music came into their lives. I mean, was yours a childhood filled with music?
Yes, it was. I did have a childhood filled with music. And, you know, mother says that I sang before I spoke. So I feel like music was always part of my life, part of my internal life. It's really funny now because I have a 6-year-old and he is constantly singing. So it's also just a delight to watch this process of being your own radio. I'm like, oh, I did that. And he's doing it now, too. But my mother always sang in the house, and we would listen to old tapes of Ethiopian music and then a lot of American radio. And so, yes, those were kind of my three influences, the internal melodic infrastructure that I arrived here on Earth with, Ethiopian music and American radio. Yeah.
Your latest album is called A Piece of Infinity, and it's, I believe, your sixth. And it's steeped in the traditions of Ethiopian songmakers. It interweaves various dialects and influences. So for people unfamiliar with that tradition, can you center it for us? Can you describe its sound?
Yeah, so part of what I wanted to do with this record was to give a real variety and diversity of sounds. You know, Ethiopia has 80 languages and 300 dialects and as many musical traditions. And so part of what I was doing was showing how there is an infinity inside of Ethiopian music, you know, and it isn't just one thing. Like, you've got to think of it like a prism that will reflect a million colors. And so I sing songs in Amharic, in Fon Oromo, in Kambatinya, in English, and I'm also like working with some rhythms that are Guraginya rhythms. So there's just a huge variety, but a lot of it is steeped in pentatonic scales, percussion-driven sounds, and just the emotional landscape of a music that embraces the plaintive, the longing, the yearning, the like, you're not going to sing if you're not feeling it. So it's like a very deep color, whatever the color is, whether the song is like a purple or a green or a yellow, like it's like a very deep yellow, you know?
And is that where the title is from? Like, these are pieces of that infinite tradition?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I decided to make an album of Ethiopian traditional music and interpretations of it about 10 years ago. And as I was sort of developing this idea, I just knew as the project evolved that it would have to include this idea of the multiplicity in order to kind of hold it. Because I didn't want anyone pointing to this album saying, this is what Ethiopian music is. I wanted to be a mirror that showed how much there was to learn, explore, understand about the breadth and depth of the culture.
And so are these songs traditional folk songs, or are these traditional folk songs that you've riffed on to create your own?
It's kind of a mix. So there's six traditional songs. Ababa Yuhosh, Gifata, Aramalamala, and Dale Shura. Those are the traditional songs on the record. But we did a lot of reinterpretation. So for example, Tizata is a song of longing and nostalgia. It's one of the most classic songs that people think of when they think of Ethiopian music. And we totally remade it sonically, but what we kept was this idea of the longing and nostalgia that's at the heart of what a tizata is. So the lyrics are traditional and the feeling is traditional, but the sound is very contemporary and, you know, something coming out of an experience of being a San Francisco jazz musician. So it's all together in the sound, yeah.
You've talked about that song having longing in it, and you can really hear that the notes and the way that they're held. Is that an emotion that resonates with you?
The way that I see tizata is that it's kind of like in Cape Verde or Brazil, they have the idea of saudade. It's very similar, this bitter sweetness, the way that life is always moving and we can't catch it even if we try, you know? So I feel like everybody has a tizata. They have a love, and it might be a romantic love. It might be like a childhood love. You know, it might be something from your deep past that you know you can never return to. But the feeling of looking back on what is past, of what has slipped through our fingers, also feels good to us to remember, to not forget. And so that's how I see what tizata is.
I love that. There's another song on the album. You mentioned it. It's one of the traditional songs, Abeba Yahosh. And I wanted the listeners to get a taste of it here.
Abeba Yahosh.
Tell us a little bit about the origins of that song and why you felt it was important to include it on the album.
Yeah, so that song is one of my faves. That song is...
I can see why.
It's a New Year's song. So it's an Ethiopian New Year's song. Ethiopian New Year's is September 11th. So there's also a thread running through this record, which is about women and girls' songs. And so Abba Ba Yehosh is a song that young women sing on Ethiopian New Year's, and they go around in groups and sing house to house this song, Abba Ba Yehosh, and they bring the yellow flowers. So the Ade Abba Ba are the yellow flowers that cover the Ethiopian hillsides in September. And I think of it like an ecological New Year's, like June, July, August, it's very rainy. And then the rains end, and that is when the new year begins. That's when the springtime announces itself with these yellow flowers on the hills. And these girls go around house to house singing and welcoming the new year. And so I've just always really loved that song, and also loved this idea of the songs that women and girls sing. Dali Shura is another women and girls song. And part of that was also like we recorded at Women's Audio Mission. And because of that, every single engineer who made this album was a woman. Marianne Zahorsky recorded it. Gloria Kaba mixed it. Jessica Thompson mastered it. Women are the featured artists on the record. The wonderful Brandi Younger is featured on Tizata and Camille Thurman on the song My Gold. And the American Women's History Initiative also supported this record in collaboration with Smithsonian Folkways. So there's a big presence of the strength and power of women and girls on this record. And that includes in this song, Abba Ba Yehosh.
You know, when one is an immigrant, you can be either immersed in the culture that your family has come from or somewhat distant from that tradition. And so I wonder for you, were you immersed in the tradition or is it something that you had to find for yourself?
You know, I grew up in a very Ethiopian household, but we also lived in Iowa when I was young, which was very much not an Ethiopian world.
Yeah.
But also which was very welcoming and wonderful. And then we moved to Brooklyn, which was, you know, the world was on our block. So I grew up with Ethiopian culture, but I did learn a lot as an adult, particularly when I started traveling to Ethiopia and collaborating with musicians there. So I think it was both. Like there was a part of it that was just inside of me, and then there was a part of it that I really had to reach for and really had to learn. And I've been so grateful that Ethiopia has been the place where I've had the biggest audiences and where my music plays all the time on the radio and national TV and all this stuff. So that has been a delight. And let me tell you, a surprise.
Well, your parents must be proud of you, too, for that. Well, you've been here in the Bay Area for over two decades. And I wonder, how has being in the Bay Area influenced your work?
So much, so much. When I came to the Bay Area, that was when I started allowing myself to be a musician. I had all kinds of ideas about what kind of training I needed before I could write songs. But the kind of approach that singer-songwriters had out here was, which was just sing your truth, allowed me to just jump in. And I started taking voice lessons like as soon as I got here. But then like a month later, I had written my first song. So San Francisco gave me the freedom to just try it, just do it. And you learn by doing. And so I'm incredibly grateful for that. And I also early on was co-director of the Red Poppy Art House and one of the organizers of the Mission Arts and Performance Project. And those places gave me my template for how I do what I do even today.
We have been talking with San Francisco treasure, the singer, the songwriter, the vocalist, the composer, Maclet Hadero. She has a new album, A Piece of Infinity, which was released at the end of September. Definitely find it wherever you get your music because it is a wonderful, wonderful listen. It's been so much fun talking to you, Maclet.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a really fun talking with you as well.
And that's State of the Bay this week. Join us next week. We'll be talking about the increased use of police drones in San Francisco and why that has residents worried. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit our page on KALW.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, email us, stateofthebay@KALW.org. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. The first and last segments were engineered by Devin Strolovich, and Eric Jansen was our board operator. Stay tuned to hear an episode of Your Calls series, The Authoritarian Playbook. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.